The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
We've now added another diet to the menu, which is the Mediterranean diet. And this can potentially be considered another first-line dietary option, which many patients can go away and do themselves.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine, in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled The Mediterranean Diet for Irritable Bowel Syndrome. Joining us on the podcast is Dr. Imran Aziz, who's an author of the paper and an honorary consultant gastroenterologist at Sheffield Teaching Hospitals, NHS Foundation Trust, and a senior clinical lecturer at the University of Sheffield. We hope that you will learn quite a bit about irritable bowel syndrome and dietary treatments. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Imran, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I was really fascinated by your study because irritable bowel syndrome is way more common than we'd like it to be. And the patients are frustrated and the physicians are frustrated. And the fact that someone actually did a randomized controlled trial of diet impressed the heck out of me. So the first thing that I'd like you to talk about is what stimulated this study? That is, what observations led to developing an RCT, particularly using Mediterranean diet versus the standard diet?
Firstly, Bob, thank you so much for inviting me onto your podcast. It's a real pleasure to be here. So with regards to this study, as you mentioned, IBS or irritable bowel syndrome is very common. It affects around 1 in 10 people. And individuals with IBS experience chronic abdominal pain, bloating and a change in bowel habit. And importantly, these symptoms are occurring in the absence of an organic disease. So, for example, there's no evidence of cancer or inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease, etc. Rather, these symptoms are functional in nature, and that's because the pathophysiology is that it's a disturbance in the brain gut axis. Now, with regards to the healthcare utilization for patients with IBS, as you know, many people seek healthcare advice. And in fact, it's the most common GI condition that we encounter both in primary and secondary care. And it leads to substantial reduced quality of life for patients, but also a lot of healthcare utilization. When it comes to managing people with IBS, we really focus on three main elements. One is diet, the other is drugs, and the third is brain gut behavioral therapies. However, we know from our clinical practice that the vast majority of people with IBS feel that food triggers their symptoms. And so most people would prefer a dietary modification as opposed to taking, let's say, a drug, which makes complete sense. When it comes to the diets that are available for IBS, I think it's important, Bob, to mention that we should steer clear of what you might see on social media platforms like Instagram or TikTok, etc., because a lot of it's fad diets that are not evidence-based. But rather, we should be considering the two evidence-based diets for IBS. Number one is traditional dietary advice. And that is based on adopting healthy and sensible eating patterns. So, for example, cutting out fatty food, spicy food, processed food, alcohol, caffeine, fizzy drinks, etc. So really get rid of all potential junk. And that will help around 40% of people with IBS. If that doesn't work, we then move on to the second line dietary therapy, which is the low FODMAP diet. Can I ask you, Bob, are you aware of the low FODMAP diet?
I actually am. I have a daughter who is a
Okay.
dietitian with a master's in nutrition, and the way she described the diet is you start with everything and then you take one away and see if it helps.
Yes and no. Well, given that your daughter's a dietitian, hopefully she will enjoy reading this paper that we publish in the Annals. But when it comes to the low FODMAP diet, for your listeners who may not be aware of this because it is a general medical audience, FODMAP is an acronym that stands for, and just bear with me, fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So for the layperson, basically that means fermentable carbohydrates. And we know that if an individual takes a low FODMAP diet, then it can help to improve the symptoms of IBS. By around 70% of people feel that it benefits them, those that have IBS. But there's a real problem with the low FODMAP diet. And the problems are is that it's, for a patient perspective, it is very difficult and very restrictive because you're eliminating initially between 50 to 100 food items. And the problem with that is that it could potentially lead to nutritional imbalances. We don't know what effect it's having on the gut microbiome. So there's a lot of uncertainties with the low FODMAP diet. The second crucial point, and this is very important for anybody who goes away and prescribes a low FODMAP diet, never, ever tell your patients to do it on their own, simply because it's too difficult. And what you need is a dietitian or a nutritionist on board to guide you through. But this is where there's another problem. Unfortunately, I can only talk on behalf of the UK right now when I work in the National Health Service, but I'm sure you have similar problems in the US, but also across the globe, in that healthcare systems are really stretched and it's very difficult to get appointments with healthcare providers. So they're the two diets that we have for IBS. So this then leads me on to the Mediterranean diet, but just before I go there, in 2023 in the UK, we held something called the James Lind Alliance Priority Setting Partnership, which is a meeting that gathers patients with IBS and healthcare providers. And in that meeting, we identified top research priorities. And of the top 10, one of the top research priorities was what other diets can we use for IBS? So clearly patients want more options. And this is where the Mediterranean diet came into place. So as you'll be aware from the papers that were published, I think predominantly in the New England Journal of Medicine, but also in the Annals, the Mediterranean diet has established health benefits for your cardiometabolic health and your psychological health. So it's a very good diet. It's never previously been entertained in the setting of IBS until a few years ago, where there was a small randomized trial from Australia that showed that the Mediterranean diet is acceptable and feasible for people with IBS. That was their primary endpoint. But as part of their endpoints, a secondary endpoint showed that it had a substantial improvement in IBS symptoms. And it was based on those findings that triggered the thought of us doing a large randomized trial in the UK.
Well, that sounds great. Let's talk about the RCT. Who went into the RCT and how did you measure the severity of IBS?
Okay, so this RCT was conducted primarily in my home working city, which is Sheffield in the UK. I'm not sure many people will know where that is in the UK. But for any of you that follow, let's say, I know you call it soccer in the US, which doesn't make any sense to me, but for those of you that follow football, it's around an hour away from Manchester United or Manchester City. So that's where Sheffield is. It's in a beautiful part of the UK, actually, very green and hilly. It's a fabulous place in the world. But when it comes to this randomized trial, it was done centrally in Sheffield, but we also had 13 participant identification centres from across the UK. And these centres were all given leaflets where, if they met an individual with IBS in their clinical practice, they could pass on this leaflet, which had a QR code, and individuals could scan the QR code, register their details, which zoomed into Sheffield. And then our research team contacted those individuals, to check whether they had IBS, to check the severity of their IBS, and that on your particular, to just to answer your point further, you ask about how we measured the IBS severity. That was on a scale called the IBS Symptom Severity Scale, which is a very simple questionnaire comprising five items, and that can give you a score of between 0 to 500. And if you score less than 75, you do not have IBS. If you score between 75 to 175, you have mild IBS. If you score between 175 to 300, it's moderate. And then 300 to 500 is severe. We also screen the patients for their predominant IBS subtype, because some people have constipation, some people have diarrhea, and others have a combination of both, which is called mixed pattern IBS. So we screen for eligibility. If patients were eligible, then at that point they were assigned or randomized either a diet A or a diet B. This is crucial because at that point we did not tell them what the two diets were. We simply told them these are you've been assigned to diet A or diet B. These diets may be of benefit in people with IBS, but we're doing a large study to evaluate this further. Those individuals that were assigned diet A were then attended maybe a week or two later an online dietary session for diet A, and the same applied for diet B separately. And it was at the time of attendance to their online dietary session where further information was disclosed. So those that attended for diet A were then told you are being assigned traditional dietary advice. They were given a 30-minute PowerPoint presentation followed by educational resources. They were not told what diet B was. And similarly, for the group that were assigned diet B, when they attended their online session for diet B, they were told this is the Mediterranean diet. As we know, just for your listeners again, the Mediterranean diet is large in fruit and veg, whole grains, nuts, fish, and plenty of extra virgin olive oil. And again, they were given a 30-minute PowerPoint presentation followed by educational resources. And then both groups simply went away, followed the diet, and completed online questionnaires over a period of 6 weeks. And these questionnaires, the primary endpoint was to measure the IBS symptom severity score. But we also had a range of secondary endpoints that looked at, for example, which was one, the IBS symptom severity score in greater detail. So just to elaborate on that further, the primary outcome was a 50-point reduction in the IBS symptom severity score. That denotes a clinically meaningful response and is commonly used in clinical trials. So that was a primary endpoint. The secondary endpoint was the mean change in the IBS symptom severity score and its individual elements, which are abdominal pain frequency, abdominal pain severity, bloating, bowel dissatisfaction, and IBS related quality of life. We also had secondary outcomes that were measuring general quality of life, mood, somatic symptoms, dietary satisfaction and adherence. We also measured nutritional intake as well. So these were the outcomes that were measured.
So, it's a 6-week study.
Yes.
We don't need to know all the results, but to you, as you wrote the article, and as you sat down and discussed it with your team, what are the most important results? What are the results that we should really remember?
Yeah, so briefly, when it comes to the study flow, as people will see from the paper in Annals, it's obviously quite heavy, but the main take-home point is that 71 people were assigned traditional dietary advice and 68 people were assigned the Mediterranean diet. And then if we look at the baseline characteristics between the two groups, they were very similar and representative, and that's important, representative of what you would classically see in your practice. So most people were females, around 80%, middle-aged, around 40 years of age, predominantly white ethnicity. Interestingly, 50% of our referrals were from Sheffield, the central site, but we also had the other 50% from the external sites. The vast majority of participants had moderate to severe IBS, which is typical of secondary care practice. And the vast majority also had mixed pattern or diarrhea, predominant IBS, which is again what you would expect to see. And then when it comes to the main take-home point, with regards to the primary endpoint, which was a 50-point reduction in IBS symptom severity score, this was seen in 62% of people assigned the Mediterranean diet versus 42% assigned the traditional dietary advice. So there's a 20 percentage point difference. We designed this as a non-inferiority trial, but based on the findings, and I've got to admit here, outside my ability to do stats, the statistician was able to do superiority testing and found that actually the Mediterranean diet was not inferior, but actually superior to traditional dietary advice. Now, some gastroenterologists in research will be aware that the 50-point reduction arguably is a possibly a soft endpoint. So we also looked at a 100-point reduction. And again, we found that the Mediterranean diet was better than traditional dietary advice, 44% versus 32%. In terms of secondary endpoints, both the traditional dietary advice and the Mediterranean diet led to an improvement in the IBS symptom severity score, the mean score, but there was a greater magnitude of response with the Mediterranean diet. So the IBS symptom severity score with the Mediterranean diet dropped by nearly 100 points versus 65 points for traditional dietary advice. So almost a 35-point difference. And moreover, individuals with the Mediterranean diet had less frequent days with abdominal pain. And then we also looked at the time to response, and we found that actually the response was fairly quick within the 6 weeks, within a fortnight, we saw an improvement. In terms of other secondary endpoints like anxiety and depression, etc., we did not see much here, but arguably it was only over a 6 week period. And we do know that the Mediterranean diet, for example, does have benefits for psychological health in other studies. So maybe if we pursue this for a longer period, we may have seen that signal. And then finally, we assessed dietary adherence and nutrition. And this is important. So satisfaction was similar between the groups. However, this was a pragmatic trial where patients had to go away and do the diet themselves. So we had a surrogate way of measuring adherence, and that was by using a screening tool called the MIDAS, which stands for Mediterranean Diet Adherence Score. And we found that with the MIDAS score, there was almost a 4-point increase in those assigned a Mediterranean diet, whereas there's only 1 point with those assigned a traditional dietary advice, which kind of shows that the group that was given the Mediterranean diet did follow it. And if you read the literature suggests that if you have a 2-point increase, then you are following the Mediterranean diet, and it's going to have it's, it is good for your cardiac health. What we also noticed is that there was no major changes in nutritional intake, but interestingly, the group that was assigned the Mediterranean diet had an increase in fiber, folate, magnesium, but probably most interestingly, oligosaccharides, which is actually a FODMAP. And this is where it gets really interesting because the Mediterranean diet is the opposite, essentially, of a low FODMAP diet. And then that brings into question what is going on here in terms of from a mechanistic perspective. And we can't answer that at this moment in time because the study was a clinical study, not a mechanistic study, but it may well be looking at what's been reported again within the literature that the beneficial effects of a Mediterranean diet may be due to its synergism and certain components like olive oil have anti-inflammatory and antioxidant benefits. So that might be a school of thought. And the other thought is, of course, the Mediterranean diet, because it's a very rich and diverse diet, we may well be flourishing the gut microbiome. And having a happy gut microbiome means a happy brain-gut axis.
So now that you've done the study and you've discussed with people, and I'm sure that you've given plenty of talks about it, and everybody's interested in the results. This is classics. Is why would you study that? But everybody wants to know what you found. Where are you right now, and what do you think we know, and what do you think we still need to learn more about?
Okay, so in terms of where we are right now, I think it's important to appreciate the current landscape. And the current landscape is when it comes to dietary therapies and IBS, on the menu is traditional dietary advice and a low FODMAP diet. And as I've discussed, a low FODMAP diet is a very difficult diet to do. We now have we've now added another diet to the menu, which is the Mediterranean diet. And this can potentially be considered another first-line dietary option, which many patients can go away and do themselves. So what that means is that if you are suffering with IBS, depending on your current diet and your wishes, you could either look into adopting a traditional dietary advice or a Mediterranean diet. Hopefully they will work. If they don't, then the next step would be to consider the second line dietary options. So maybe, and we hope to hopefully show this in the future, we will reduce further referrals to secondary care for a low FODMAP diet. However, what we don't know are, for example, the long-term effects of this diet, because it was only 6 weeks in duration, so that's a major limitation. As I've discussed, we do not know the mechanisms, and that I think deserves further exploration. And the final thing we will say is that this study was done in adults, Bob, and a lot of kids also have IBS. So it would be interesting to see how this plays out in that cohort.
Well, I can't thank you enough for publishing this study, raising the bar on thinking about this. I think it's going to help all of our listeners have another tool in the toolbox when patients come in to consider this. And I really thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for having me, Bob. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. The main message in this article is that the Mediterranean diet is probably better than traditional, quote, healthy dietary advice. It's probably a very reasonable diet for people with IBS. It's very unclear how it works, and this study was not meant to look at the mechanisms of how different diets work. It's relatively easy for patients to adopt, and patients in the 6-week trial seem to do a very good job of staying with the Mediterranean diet. And we know from other studies that the Mediterranean diet is an acceptable diet for many people. Because we don't understand the mechanisms, and because it was only a 6-week study, there's still some holes in our knowledge, but as our guest suggests, when you're dealing with IBS and you're trying to come up with a diet, it's very reasonable to consider the Mediterranean diet in the initial discussion of what diets might help the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall